Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Robert Gletcher, Assistant Professor of History at the University of Richmond, who assesses reaction in the Middle East to Israel's recent bombing raid against Syria. David Cowan, Professor of Economics at the University of California, who takes a look at the economic crisis which will confront California's new governor, Arnold Schwarzenegger. And David Hill, Director of the Leonard Peltier Defense Committee, who discusses the latest developments in the case of the imprisoned Native American activist who his supporters believe was unjustly convicted of murder. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Few people are eager to talk about what happened to Canadian photojournalist Zahra Kazema inside the walls of Evin Prison in Tehran, Iran. She was picked up by the police on June 23rd and later beaten to death while being interrogated. According to the World Press Review magazine, even vocal members of the large reform bloc in Iran's parliament are afraid to talk about the case. The killing of Kazema, an Iranian native, was part of an intense crackdown on dissent by Iran's judicial and executive agencies in response to powerful pro-democracy protests on Tehran's campuses. The crackdown that included the roundup of activists and journalists led to a major split in Iran's pro-reform parliament. As one reform legislator commented, Iran's President Mohammad Khatami's insistence on change through consensus has reached the end of its usefulness. The time has come for confrontation. However, the reform movement recently got a boost when Iranian human rights advocate Shirin Ebadi won the Nobel Peace Prize. A lawyer and former judge, Ebadi is the first Muslim woman to win the Peace Prize. She has pledged to fight for activists imprisoned by Iran's religious hardliners. Media activists, flush with the success in getting many members of Congress to oppose recent media deregulation initiatives by the Federal Communications Commission, are now looking to block renewal of broadcast licenses. Over the next few months, dissident FCC Commissioner Michael Copps is planning a new set of public hearings to see if radio and TV broadcasters are serving the public interest and thus eligible to have their licenses renewed. The Raleigh, North Carolina-based News and Observer reports that renewal of existing licenses could be contested. Activists are already looking at five stations owned by Clear Channel Communications in North Carolina, whose licenses expire on December 1st. Listeners are already upset with shock jock Bob Dumas on Clear Channel's WDGC-FM G105 for making hostile comments about bicyclists and going so far as to laugh about stories of motorists running down bike riders. In Washington, D.C., Essential Information, a group founded by Ralph Nader, has already challenged licenses to Clear Channel stations in the District of Columbia and three other states. The public interest group accused Clear Channel of running deceptive promotions and broadcasting obscene and indecent content. Over the past 20 years, radio stations have routinely renewed their licenses with little scrutiny from the FCC. But media reform activists say the lax process has resulted in a deterioration in programming that serves the public interest. The Broadway play Take Me Out won the Tony Award last year for depicting the celebrated life of a New York baseball hero who tells the public that he is gay. In the reality of big-time sports, no gay professional ballplayer has ever come out of the closet. In recent years, there were rumors surrounding New York Mets slugger Mike Piazza. It went so far that Piazza called a press conference to state, "I'm heterosexual." Professional team sports, including baseball, football, and hockey, is one of the few arenas left, besides the military, where gays are not tolerated. Over the last decade, several retired baseball players have disclosed their same-sex orientation, but they remained in the gay closet while in the big leagues. According to In These Times magazine, there has been intense media speculation in recent years about gay professional athletes. 2 years ago, ESPN paid for a poll that asked fans if their team loyalty would be hurt if a star player came out as gay. Only 17% of fans say their team spirit would be damaged by the disclosure. 63% said it would make no difference, and 20% said it would make them bigger fans. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
Not since the 1973 Middle East War have Israelis and Syrians attacked each other's territory. That 30-year ceasefire ended on October 5th when Israel launched a pre-dawn bombing raid against what they described as a terrorist training camp just 15 miles northwest of the Syrian capital, Damascus. The government of Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon said the attack was launched in retaliation for a Palestinian suicide bombing the day before in Haifa, which killed 20 people. The Syrians stated that the camp which was bombed had long ago been abandoned and denied the accusation from Washington and Israel that their government harbored members of Hamas and Islamic Jihad who regularly carry out attacks inside Israel. Syria immediately introduced a resolution at the UN Security Council condemning the Israeli attack. But the Bush administration, which had withheld public criticism of the Israeli airstrike, threatened to veto the Syrian resolution. While Syria's military is widely believed to be unable to stop any future Israeli attack, spokespersons for the government of Bashar al-Assad said the nation will respond with all means possible in case that aggression is repeated. Growing anger in the Arab street fueled concern around the world that any similar Israeli offensive against its neighbors could trigger a new regional Middle East conflict. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Robert Bletcher, assistant professor of history at the University of Richmond, who assesses reaction in the Middle East to Israel's recent bombing raid against Syria.
For a long time now, Israel has been trying to distract attention from the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza by claiming that Palestinian resistance to the occupation is the result of outside instigation. Yasser Arafat is the clearest example of somebody who has been blamed. The Israeli government has regularly made the claim that all of the Palestinian resistance of the last 3 years can be attributed to Yasser Arafat's decision to choose a violent path after the failed Camp David negotiations. At this point, Yasser Arafat, as a tool or as somebody who can be blamed, is wearing a little bit thin, because the Israeli government has been talking about this for a while. The Israeli government has not acted against Yasser Arafat, and so it's looking like, well, why aren't they doing something if this person is really, really to blame for the deaths of all these Israelis? And so at this point, the Israeli government needs a different outside instigator, as it were, to blame for the resistance, and it finds that outside instigator in Syria. So it has this training camp where the woman who perpetrated the bombing in Haifa last week, she had never been to Syria, she had never been to that training camp. It's entirely unclear what kind of assistance the Israeli government or the American government or anybody is thinking that she might have received from this little patch of territory outside of Damascus. But despite the fact that there's no real substantive connection between her and Syria, again, this serves as a way to deflect attention from the fact that the Israeli government, led by Ariel Sharon, has no military or political response to Palestinian resistance and is only perpetuating it by the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza.
How do you respond to the Sharon government's accusation that Syria harbors and assists terrorist groups such as Hamas and Islamic Jihad that regularly carry out suicide bombings in Israel?
Well, once again, it's a little bit hard to understand exactly what kind of assistance is being provided. The American intelligence sources said the day after the attack that they had absolutely no information. They could not confirm that there was any kind of terrorist training bases in Syria, and certain American officials said that they had certain reports, presumably these reports came from Israeli intelligence, that particular base was being upgraded, meaning that in the past it had been used by the PFLP-GC, that is the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine General Command, but that organization has long been dormant, so the territory was just lying kind of empty. Supposedly, according to these U.S. sources, it was being upgraded recently for some other purpose, but according to the U.S. sources, there's no indication that that base is actually being used for anything. It was just in preparation for something that is extremely unclear. Are there members of Islamic Jihad and members of Hamas, these militant organizations that are being targeted by the Israeli government and now the U.S. government? Are there members of those organizations in Syria and Lebanon? Yes, there are. Syria does not consider those organizations to be terrorist organizations. It considers those organizations to be resistance organizations. So there are members of those organizations in those countries. Whether or not they are providing any kind of substantive material assistance to the resistance in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, I think that needs to be seriously doubted.
Do you feel that this Israeli action, this bombing on the territory of Syria, could lead to a regional war that would go beyond just the long conflict between Israelis and Palestinians since the last Middle East war?
One needs to be careful in predicting major escalations based on single incidences. A lot of people made predictions about what would happen in Iraq during the first Gulf War, and people made predictions about what was going to happen in Iraq during the second Gulf War and the most recent Gulf War, and people were wrong because they didn't have real substantive information to proceed with. So I don't want to look into my crystal ball and make some kind of fortune teller prediction about what's going to happen, but I will say the following. First of all, Ariel Sharon has demonstrated in the past that he has been willing to enter into major wars with countries on Israel's border for the sake of quelling Palestinian resistance within the occupied territories. In 1982, Israel invaded Lebanon. Ariel Sharon at the time was the defense minister, and in fact, as defense minister, he greatly superseded the orders which he had been given. He took the war a lot further in Lebanon, all the way up to Beirut. He went beyond the mandate that had been provided by the Israeli government at a tremendous loss of life to Lebanese, and also ultimately to Israeli soldiers who were occupying the south of that country until recently. So Ariel Sharon has a history of launching attacks on neighboring countries, and if that were to happen with Syria, people would just say, well, this is the same thing again from Ariel Sharon 20 years later, a very consistent path.
The Sharon government justified its attack on Syrian territory by pointing out the Bush administration's preemptive war policy, which says it's fair game to go after nations that they say harbor terrorists. And of course, the Bush administration wasn't too hard at all on Israel. Many people may have interpreted that in Jerusalem as a green light. What are the risks that the Bush administration is taking by not severely reprimanding Israel and its actions against Syria? Are they opening up the door to renewed regional conflicts, more attacks from Israel on Syria and other nations in the region?
I would answer your question yes. In fact, I would add another green light that might have been provided by the U.S. government to Israel to carry out the attack, was that the attack came after the Syrian Accountability Act, which has been in play in Congress recently, which would impose new restrictions on trade with Syria. That also came back to the fore before the attack, and unlike in previous instances when this bill was debated, the administration said that it would probably not veto the bill this time, as previous administrations have said. So that could be interpreted as yet another signal that the U.S. government is happy to have Israel go after Syria. Do I think that the U.S.'s failure to criticize Israel more severely could give Israel the indication that its actions are acceptable? Yes, absolutely.
That was Robert Bletcher, assistant professor of history at the University of Richmond and a regular contributor to Middle East Report. Contact Middle East Report by calling area code 202-233-3677 or visit their website at www.merip.org. Mimicking the script of a predictable Hollywood melodrama, action hero Arnold Schwarzenegger came out of political obscurity to lead California's recall election campaign that removed incumbent Democratic Governor Gray Davis from office and replace him. But after appealing for votes on a pledge to raise no new taxes and to repeal the state's new automobile tax, the multimillionaire movie star confronts a state budget deficit that could total more than $20 billion by next year. Upon becoming only the second governor in American history to win office in a recall election, the actor was congratulated by President Bush and called upon GOP Congressman David Dreyer to lead his transition team. Throughout the abbreviated campaign, the Republican Party has denied frequent accusations that it had engineered the recall election in order to gain advantage in the nation's most populous state for President Bush's 2004 reelection bid. Just weeks before taking office, Schwarzenegger and his supporters have not yet provided details on how they will solve California's budget dilemma, beyond asking for a federal bailout from their Republican friends in Washington. One bright spot for progressives in California's October 7th election was the defeat of Proposition 54, which would have banned the state from collecting data on race and ethnicity to track demographic trends in such areas as education and health care. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with David Cowan, professor of economics at the University of California at Santa Cruz, who takes a look at the economic crisis that will confront California's new governor, a crisis that has gripped most of the nation's 50 states.
California enacted Proposition 13 in the 1970s, which was literally the beginning of taxpayer revolt. This had to do with severely limiting increases in property taxes. Now, that had a number of implications that we're still living with. Among the most important was reducing the primary source of revenue for local governments. What that means is that the primary source of state revenue comes from the most volatile source of revenue. That is, one can predict pretty much real estate values, one can predict pretty much excise taxes, people continue to buy food and so forth and so on, but income taxes vary substantially. So that's one of the problems. So the dramatic decline in state revenues, to some extent unforeseen. So if you put all those things together, a very unpopular governor, difficult economic circumstances, and then the other thing, which is perhaps less political and has to do more with the quality of information that's available, a very popular person that people seem to rally around for no good reason other than he was a charming movie star.
What does Arnold Schwarzenegger, as governor of California, face in terms of deficits and the choices available to him to bridge the gap between the state's deficit and its spending priorities?
I honestly think that what Schwarzenegger is going to have to do is find some way to define our present situation as an emergency. If you recall, what Schwarzenegger said about taxes was he said he would absolutely not raise taxes, save for an earthquake or an emergency. Now, there is speculation that once he looks at the economic situation of the state, he will see an emergency. That's probably the least likely scenario. It's the scenario that would be the most appropriate, as far as I'm concerned. There is a suggestion that he may simply go to the people and propose a one-time bond issue to get us through. I've just been reading and noticing that a number of states and local governments have been trying this way of patching over the deficits that exist all around us, which is a very, very dangerous kind of policy. Basically, what Schwarzenegger is going to have to do would be rather difficult for any politician, is going to say, hey, I was lying to you when I said I won't raise taxes and I will not cut education spending and I'll find a way to balance the budget. I mean, it's simply impossible. Schwarzenegger is only the latest of typical Republican politicians who come to office. Reagan was the one who started this, saying, I can cut your taxes and balance the budget. The latest, President Bush, said exactly the same thing. The whole supply-side argument of tax cutting being good for the economy and raising government revenues has time and time again proved to be what it was originally called by Bush's father, voodoo economics. And Schwarzenegger adopts the same line. It clearly is sells in terms of voters.
Certainly among Democrats and even the labor unions who didn't want to see Schwarzenegger elected, there's got to be some ruffled feathers, and there was always the looming threat, you've taken this recall monster out of the box, and we can bring it out ourselves anytime we want. Is there the kind of acrimony among politicians and political activists in California that you think will set the state on sort of a destructive course from this time on?
In the first place, there is a time limit. Whatever group of legislators put this recall into effect in the first place did say that you could not have a recall within, I honestly forget now, there's some time limit, 6 months or something like that, so that you couldn't have a sort of parade of recalls going back and forth. The other thing is, this is my own political biases speaking, but it just seems to me that one of the disadvantages of the liberals, such as they are, Democrats, compared to Republicans, is that the former, the Democrats, don't play the game quite as roughly as the Republicans. I mean, you can see what's happening in Texas. You see what happened with the Supreme Court. So I'm not sure. I'm not sure. And it probably wouldn't be productive in the immediate sense under any circumstances. I think what people will do and what it sounds like the legislature is doing, you know, they're making all the nice comments. Davis went on Letterman and gave his 10 tips to Schwarzenegger. So I think the politicians will probably just watch rather than react. I can't speak for the union people. The union vote surely did not follow union leader desires. Something like 40% of union members voted for Schwarzenegger.
That was David Cowan, professor of economics at the University of California at Santa Cruz. Native American Leonard Peltier is in his 28th year of imprisonment, convicted and sentenced to two consecutive life terms for the murder of two FBI agents on the Pine Ridge Lakota Reservation in South Dakota in 1975. Over the years, efforts to win justice for Peltier have revealed gross misconduct on the part of the U.S. government and its agents in this case. These include coercive measures taken against a learning disabled Native American woman who perjured herself by claiming she saw Peltier shoot the agents, withholding thousands of pages of documents, and suppression of exculpatory evidence that showed Peltier's gun did not fire the bullets that killed the agents. Several years ago, the prosecutor admitted that the government couldn't prove who shot the agents. The U.S. government is now holding Peltier for aiding and abetting the homicide, a crime for which he would have been eligible for parole years ago. In September, Peltier's attorneys appealed the government's denial of parole before the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals in Denver. There, activists organized a march in support of Peltier and held a conference featuring longtime American Indian Movement leaders. Between the lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with David Hill, director of the Leonard Peltier Defense Committee, about the latest developments in Peltier's case and about the recent arrest of Bill Janklow, South Dakota's congressman and the state's former governor, attorney general, and prosecutor, who has been closely linked with Peltier's case. Janklow was recently charged with manslaughter after his car crashed into a motorcyclist, killing him.
In 1993, he went to a parole hearing, and originally he was imprisoned as the shooter. And since that time, and since the exposure of all the FBI's misconduct at his trial, they've switched their theory to him being there for aiding and abetting. And under those guidelines, he should have been paroled 11 years ago. That ruling to put his next parole hearing off to 2008 was illegal. By their own guidelines of the parole commission. And so we made an appeal to the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals in Denver last September the 19th, and they haven't ruled yet on the outcome of that hearing. Also in Denver, there were, hundreds of people there demonstrating for Leonard Peltier, wanting him to be free, and he's characterized as the epitome of an example of the mistreatment of Indian people through the judicial system and the government for Indian people all over the United States.
He's been characterized as a political prisoner by Amnesty International, isn't that correct?
Yes, that is absolutely correct. Leonard is more well-known overseas, more like Nelson Mandela than in America. America has a tendency to turn away or go quiet when you ask them about Indian people, whether it's school books or on television or anything. They're quiet about Indian people because America cannot point the finger at another country about treaty violations without pointing it at themselves also.
In the appeal, what exactly are Leonard's lawyers asking for? The first choice would be immediate parole?
Yes, that would be the first choice. And it's possible for these judges to do that. However, the government probably would appeal it. But if we can find just one court that would do the right thing and not be politically motivated, he'll be free.
What's the state of his health right now?
He's getting older. He's had trouble with one of his legs and walking. He has heart trouble. He has diabetes. He has 80% loss of vision in one eye due to a stroke a few years back. Other than that, he's spiritually he's really strong, and emotionally he's real strong, and he's encouraging to other people.
Do you have any timeline on when you might get a result from this appeal?
The attorneys told us they wouldn't get a ruling on it for maybe up to 3 months.
you know, it's been a long, long time, and as you said, Leonard's case is more well-known in other countries than it is here. But talk a little bit about the event that happened. I guess, was it on the same day as the hearing or the day right around the same weekend? People gathered in Denver. I know there were Russell Means was there. And
oh, well, we had a news forum there with Dennis Banks and some other people, Barry Bacharach, Leonard's attorney. And then we had some public forums where Russell Means and others spoke. And then on the day of the hearing, we had a rally at the state capitol. And from there, everybody walked down to the federal building where we continued the rally and had speakers and so forth. And it started off with about 300 people at the state capitol. And the numbers grew as we were going down the street to about 500 or 600, which completely filled the street for a whole city block.
Is there anything that people who support Freedom for Leonard Peltier can do to express their opinion that might make a difference while the judges are considering this, or is that not considered something that would make any difference?
I'm sure it would make a difference. They could write the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals, ask them to free Leonard Peltier, tell them to jail Janklow.
We're talking about William Janklow, former governor of South Dakota, and he was the one who basically tried to stop publication of Peter Matheson's book, In the Spirit of Crazy Horse.
When he was attorney general, he also was responsible for sending a riot squad into a courtroom and beating up a bunch of Indian people because he wouldn't stand up for the judge. Just a lot of things like that. He made a statement one time, the best way to deal with AIM people is to put a bullet in their head. And he's just run roughshod over the laws and the people up there. And he has no respect for Indian people. He's always been a prosecutor, but governor and all that stuff. And he always thought he was above the law.
It seemed like there was obviously a reorganization of Leonard's support committee.
Sometimes there's only two people running this office, and we're up against the most powerful, well-funded political organization in the world, the American government and the FBI. And, you know, they will do anything they can to keep Leonard Peltier in prison.
That was David Hill, director of the Leonard Peltier Defense Committee. Contact the Defense Committee at area code 785-842-5774 or visit their website at www.leonardpeltier.org for a history of Peltier's case and a sample letter to the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals requesting parole for the Native American activist. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.